It's Sunday afternoon and time once again for Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. And, of course, this is the third Sunday of the month, and so joining me in the studio, North Carolina Poet Laureate Kathy Smith Bowers. Hey, Kathy.
Hello, Jeff. Thank you very much. And, of course, many, many thanks to the North Carolina Department of Cultural Resources and the good people there who work so energetically to keep the arts alive in the state of North Carolina. I'm delighted to have with us today Thomas Raincrow and Nan Watkins. Thomas Raincrow is the author of several books of poetry and translation, including the Larne poems, written in Wales, and Riding the Wind, a Celtic Resurgence, which he edited. His most recent collection of poems is The Blue Rose of Venice. And we have Nan Watkins, who is a musician, translator, and author. Among her many works is a travel memoir, East Toward Dawn, A Woman's Solo Journey Around the World, published in 2002. Welcome, Thomas and Nan.
Great. It's great to be here.
Thanks, Kathy. Good to see you.
It's wonderful to have you here. Nan and Thomas, what drew me especially to your work is the beautiful collaboration of 10,000 Dawns, a translation of the love poems of poets Yvonne and Claire Gall. Could you talk a little bit about what drew you to their work?
Well, I guess, as always, it's best to start at the beginning. And my discovery of Yvonne Gall was many years ago now. I can't even remember how long it was exactly, at least 10, maybe longer. My good friend down in Spartanburg, South Carolina, John Lane, who's also a poet and teaches at Wofford, and you know John.
John is one of my dearest friends.
Right. Well, we've been friends and buddies for a lifetime practically, and I was in his house years ago and just looking through his bookshelf and looking at some of the books that he had at my leisure and came across a collection of selected poems of Yvonne Gall that was published by a San Francisco publisher I think it was in the early 70s. I think it was George Hitchcock, actually. Just out of curiosity, being that he was French and Hitchcock and the San Francisco connection, I picked it up and started reading, and I was immediately drawn to his work, taken by it. He was a French surrealist. He was at the center of the whole French Surrealist movement in Paris, as well as the Expressionist movement in Germany before that, and then spent some time in America during the war. So he was always at the center, the epicenter of where the action was in a literary sense for most of the first half of the last century. But it was the poetry, really, that drew me, you know, in. And his brand of surrealism was not the Breton brand that is very cerebral and disconnected, but more grounded, and especially the love poems. I mean, the beautiful love poems to his wife Claire, and really captivated me. And then I introduced Nan to his work, and then the story goes from there. Mm-hmm. And Nan can pick up because she kind of jumped on the wagon, so to speak, and started doing some research.
Mm-hmm. Yes, at the time I was working in Hunter Library at Western Carolina University, and when I looked up Yvonne and Claire Gall, I was just amazed to see how much work they had done, and also amazed that we hadn't really heard about them before. So one of the things we landed on right away was this book that we'd like to read a little something from, 10,000 Dawns. And for me, it's very exciting that it's a love story between a husband and a wife that lasted for 30 years. Right. And when you start thinking about it, and
what kind of weirdos were the...
Well, we did think about it. And the only other one in literature that I can come up with right away is the Brownings, Robert Browning and Elizabeth Barrett Browning. Yes. And it was very much the same way. Mm-hmm. They wrote to each other a lot before they actually married and so on. And then maybe you've come across that program that Sting did on Robert and Clara Schumann. And those were musicians now, not poets, but they had one of the great love stories. And at the very same time as the Brownings. And Sting did a gorgeous program for BBC that you can actually get on a DVD, and where they were reading the letters that Robert and Clara wrote to each other, as well as playing the music that they wrote to each other. So it's a pretty rare thing that husbands and wives can be together for a full lifetime and still end up writing great poetry.
It is possible.
It is possible, but it's...
And both creative.
Both were creative in every instance. So it's pretty exciting.
Well, I tell you, I was just so drawn to this book and just absolutely, you know, felt as if I knew them, and I just couldn't get enough of it. So, she was Russian?
No, she was German. She was born in Munich.
And he was German, too.
He was born in Alsace-Lorraine, and at that time, there were jokes there saying in the morning... when you got up, are we in France today or are we in Germany? Because that area was fought over, highly contested, before, during, and after the First World War. And Claire and Yvonne actually met in Switzerland because both of them were pacifists. And they met in 1917, which is in the middle of the war.
Yes.
And they did not want to be, you know, on one side eliminating the other. So they both met there. She read a poem of his that was about pacifism as opposed to war, and she met him, and that was it. Love at first sight. And so the 10,000 Dawns here refers to 30 years that they spent together. And when Thomas will read the title poem, it comes from the time when he slipped that poem under her door on the 30th anniversary of the day they met. Not when they married, but when they met. So that's what it's about.
What a beautiful story. And what you've done with these translations is just as beautiful as the story itself. So we are dying to hear you read. Would you please read to us?
Well, let me just preface that. We'd love to, of course. The process was that Nan did some research and did a library search and came up with some original first edition copies of some of Yvonne's and Claire's work and got them through the interlibrary loan. But the thing about the 10,000 Dawns book was that it was published in France and Germany both within a two-year period. So we had a copy of the German, and we also had an original copy of the French. So what our process was is Nan translated Claire's poems from the German, which she's fluent in, and I published Yvonne's poems from the French, which I do, and that's how the process went. Mm-hmm. So
you did them separately first, right?
Right, but talking, you know, and sharing and asking for advice
and
that kind of thing.
But then to bring this book, to bring them together, that was a whole different job.
Right.
You actually chose to publish them in a different order than either of the original first editions, right?
Right. As you know, Jeff, the original manuscripts were separate sections, a section of Claire's work and a section of Yvonne's work. And I sent them out to many publishers, and nobody was interested. And then I got a kind of an epiphany that maybe we should make this more of a conversational book, and went through and just on pure intuition tried to match up these poems back and forth, because the poems weren't dated in the original, but you could kind of, because of the subject matter, you could kind of tell, you know, he wrote something to her and she wrote something back. So
right. In fact, it was a conversation all those years back and forth. We just didn't have the exact dates involved. But it was a completely team effort when we translated. Do you want to start off with one of the nice, innocent poems?
like any relationship, there's phases and periods and ups and downs. Mm-hmm. So we'll start at the beginning where everybody's madly in love. You are elusive, like a brook gliding through mint bushes. Sometimes you shiver to the music of my metaphors. When I bend over you, the stars light up. When you look at me, you belong to me, as the eye belongs to the face. And with one of my songs on your lips, you will rendezvous with death. But you escape me. You fly off like a chord from my mandolin, elusive, my love, my life.
And Claire responds, "You are tender as the fingerprints of birds in snow. You are melancholy as the larches in the hills with tousled hair. You are sweet as the dates of Bible palms. And yes, you are stronger than a cyclone, than a hurricane, than the temple doors of bronze."
And so Yvonne responds at some point, and he writes, and this is where Yvonne really gets into his deep surrealism, and I love his surrealistic images, and this poem is really a typical poem of Yvonne Gall's. And he's writing to Claire, and he says, "Your hair sets fire to the largest burning light of the century. Your brow is the blackboard on which the secrets of men are scrawled. Your eyes are two diamonds glued into the face of the Sphinx. Your neck is an Eiffel Tower painted in pink. Your lips are twin boats that dance on the Red Sea. Your teeth are lined up like the keys of my piano. When you speak, the acacias bloom. Tin creeks laugh. And when you walk, everything swings."
And Claire is equally enamored of Yvonne when she writes, "All fresh water flows to you. Clouds fall on their knees before you. Rivers seek you all over the world. Fountains stand on tiptoe to see you better. Springs whisper your songs in all tongues. Ponds conceive new fishes to nourish you. The lakes are the broken mirrors of your dreams. A geyser gushes from my heart higher than the column of Trajan."
So you can see these guys are kind of, it's kind of a call and response, and it's almost like they're trying to one-up each other. I mean, it just keeps getting...
And I'm sitting here thinking, how come a man never wrote to me, "Your brow is the blackboard on which the secrets of men are scrawled"? That's my question.
Well, that's the magic, really, of this collection and these two writers. I mean, it's a beautiful surrealism. To me, it's a very grounded surrealism.
It reminds me a little bit of Neruda's wonderful imaginative stuff. It's just fabulous.
Right.
More.
Well, this may be a wooing poem of sorts. Yvonne's writing to Claire, and he says, "Orpheus charmed the snarling panthers, the velvety moles, the bashful ostrich, the four-storied whales, the shy ibis, the native lizards. But you, the wildest of all animals, with what song would he conquer you?"
And Claire responds to that one in her own wild way. "Tear me in a thousand pieces, royal tiger of my heart. Mutilate my smile. Pull from me screams bigger than my body. In place of my red hair, plant the white of worry. Let my feet grow old, waiting in vain for you. And squander all my tears in just 1 hour. I can do nothing but kiss your paw.
And it's Sunday afternoon. You're listening to Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis, and joining me in the studio today, North Carolina Poet Laureate Kathy Smith Bowers, and her guest, Thomas Raincrow and Nan Watkins. So let's hear some more, guys. Kathy?
Nan and Thomas, what an absolute wonderful gift you have given us, 10,000 dawns. We're just ready for more.
Well, as I mentioned a second ago, that this relationship, like most, had its ups and downs, and is a full-storied relationship. And toward the middle of it, there's a whole section of poems in the books about jealousy. And this is all predicated by affairs that both of them had during their 30-year relationship. And so there was that they were dealing with. And so we'll read a couple poems from that section where they're apologizing and trying to re-woo each other and explain these things away. So here's Yvonne. He's been caught. And so he says, "I wear you like a tattoo, your smile on my eyelids. On my lips is etched each of your kisses. The acid of your tears is burning my shirt collars. And your letters that will last forever have filled up my suits. Tattooed against all their advances, why do you even care that other women would want to sell me love?"
And they're living in Paris at this time. They made Paris their home, so the images of streets and city scenes appears here. And this is one of her first responses. "I am jealous of the street. The shadow of a woman could brush against yours. Maybe you're betraying me with a marble goddess in the museum who has waited decades for you. A tram follows you like a dog, and each girl steals a gram of my gold from your eyes. As soon as you forsake me, it will no longer be day. Morning is already evening. The butterflies are poisoned on the gas of meadow saffron. Your lyre, still glowing, will return to ashes as soon as you forsake me."
And Yvonne is quick to come back with, "They were great walking tragedies. They were pensive clouds. They were the dream in a subway window. They were snow melting in a hot hand. They were rose trees wrapped in crepe de chine. They were the sadness of the rain. They were from Russia or Brazil. They were not even women, these women. But you, I don't even know you. I can't even describe you. And yet I am filled with love."
And she's also walking in the rain. "Oh, the street is wet where yesterday I walked beside you. Rain drops from my eyes. What time of year is it? Paper roses bloom on my hat, and I have freckles from the moonbeams. A tired horse trots through me, the next world already in his eyes. He pulls a pair of levers in his carriage in the sky. But I walk alone, seeking your unfaithful shadow in this street without end, worn out from my wandering, washed in my tears."
And I think Yvonne has the last word in this conversation, speaking more or less for both of them, when he says, "This is the season of jealousy. My eyes drop like leaves from the autumn of my life. Rain strokes my hair with widowed hands. Sister Sorrow, sitting on the boot of my car, cry for me. Iron and lead are not as heavy as love." So you get a sense of what they were going through, and But it's just as interesting what they were going through outside of their relationships and what they were doing with the communities they were living in at the time. And I think, Nan, you want to talk to the subject of their lives during and before the fatal crash, so to speak.
Well, let's see. They were living in Paris all this time and interacting with other poets and painters. Yvonne had several publishing efforts where he would publish other people and would enlist the talents of the great artists like Picasso and Delaunay and help me with some of these names.
Yeah, I mean, first edition of 10,000 Dawns has illustrations Matisse.
Chagall. The Chagalls were very good friends of the Gauls, and when they all emigrated to the United States and lived in Brooklyn, New York during the Second World War, they were all friends there, the Chagalls and the Gauls. And they were busy doing these things, but we might want to mention a little bit of why all that jealousy. When Yvonne had been in Berlin and one of his plays was being given its world premiere on a big stage in Berlin, he met an Austrian poet named Paula Ludwig, and she was the direct opposite of Claire. She was earthy and loved gardening and hiking in the mountains, and Claire was a city gal, and she dressed to the nines and really, really was involved in urban activities of every sort. So I think you can honestly say that Yvonne was really very torn between the two, and he tried so hard to have a relationship with both. And, of course, that works to a certain extent, but it doesn't. But in the end, he chose Claire. And when they all had to flee Paris as the German army was moving in, during the Second World War, he chose to take Claire and go to the United States. And that was then the end of any relationship he had with Paula. But
Well, and during this time, I think it's important to mention that, and I think both of us would agree that Yvonne Gall is one of the best kept secrets in Western literature, and he was at the epicenter of everything that was going on in Germany and France and America during that first half of the century. He was friends of James Joyce. He was the first person to publish Ulysses in German. He was a friend of Mayakovsky and Beckett and Aragon. He collaborated with Kurt Weill. He wrote the first Theater of the Absurd plays, preceding Artaud and Ionesco. So, I mean, this guy was...
He made Breton angry at him when he wrote his own manifesto of surrealism.
Yeah, and I'm almost convinced that he wrote the first manifesto of surrealism, and Breton maybe 2 days later followed it up, with his own version, and that's the one that people refer to now. But there's another one.
You know what? I'd like to read one little poem that shows in all of this. Sometimes Claire was very lonely, and there's some beautiful images in this poem. I lost the evening star, my favorite jewelry, in a taxi. I lost my beloved on the playground of angels between Mars and France. A monsoon starts in my eyes. The ravens are in mourning. The young birds stop growing. My beloved and the evening star were one and the same. Flowers, go on strike with me. Stop smiling. She's sad. It's not there's not any kind of real rivalry. I mean, she deeply loves Yvonne, and of course she then goes and has her flings, not any one particular person, but several, and they're both feeling a lot of grief as well as happiness.
Yeah, including Rilke, right? Wasn't he one of her lovers?
Oh yes, 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 and. in her very early days, she took her first volume of poems, and she wanted to hear what Rilke said about them. So she made the trip back to Munich, and they had a dalliance, and there's a book about filled with the letters between Rilke and Claire Gall, and that has not been published in English. It's still in German, and she had a real affair with him, and then chose Ivan.
Wow. So this really is the anatomy of a love affair. The whole, you know, every aspect of it is just absolutely beautiful. So so what happens next with these two?
Well, Nan's been working on a biography that's unrealized at this point, but doing research. And so there's an enormous amount of material there about their lives and their work. But what the three main periods that we cover in the book are the beginning stages of the romance, and then the jealousy. And then the third stage is Yvonne is diagnosed with leukemia. He's in his 40s, I guess, and they're living in America, waiting out the war, and he's diagnosed with leukemia. And this is a whole big twist in their lives and their relationship. And eventually they make their way back to Paris, where he spends the remaining years of his life. And so most of the poems, including the book Traumkraut, which Nan has just finished translating, deal with Yvonne's waiting for the death angel, more or less. I mean, he knows his life is coming to an end, and he's trying to deal with it. So a lot of his poems are about death and dealing with that. And so he writes, "Oh, I want to complain about the owl who knocks on the doors of night, always dressed in autumn, fed on moldy old stars, and bound to thousand-year-old trees. I want to complain about the smart owl who fakes eternal pain while making love, or cries like the root of all evil, who with a million wounds pours out all his white blood. In the cold night, you listen to my complaints, but you can't hear my heart near you, beating to the drum of death."
Thomas is fond of saying that timing is everything, and I think in Yvonne's life, his timing was particularly difficult. He was diagnosed in New York City in 1945, with this leukemia, and the doctors knew there was nothing they could do at the time to save him from it. So not only that, he had been over in the United States during the war. The war was over, so you would think that there was a ray of light, and he had just received his American citizenship. But then he gets this death sentence. So it was very, very difficult. And they managed to stay on in New York because they had many, many friends when they were here. They knew William Carlos Williams. They knew James Laughlin up at New Directions. They knew the Patchens, Kenneth and Miriam Patchen. I talked to Miriam Patchen for quite a long time when she was still living. And she gave the most vivid pictures of what it was like to be with Yvonne and Claire in their lovely little townhouse on the East River in Brooklyn. So they had been very engaged in every possible way in New York, every bit as much as they had been in Paris. And now they have to go back. So in this last segment, we'll read a little more about the end.
Well, good. Yeah, I know when there was a translation of some of Yvonne's poems while they were still living in the States, and the translators were like a who's who of American poetry at the time, from William Carlos Williams on.
That's exactly right.
Amazing. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because, and Louise Bogen, who was the poetry editor at the New Yorker, she was, I mean, they knew everybody.
I'm just going to read this one.
Well, let's hear some more.
So, one of the great stories in my mind in modern literature is as Yvonne's dying in a Paris hospital, he's got this entourage of some of the most famous artists and poets in the world at the time as friends, and so they're all coming to the hospital to visit and to pay their respects, but more importantly, perhaps, is there a lot of them, and this is chronicled historically, and we're trying to find out who these people actually were, donated their blood to Yvonne so that he could stay alive long enough to finish his book Traumkraut. So his final work that Nan has just translated is really written with the blood of some of the most famous and gifted artists and poets of the 20th century. I mean, that's an incredible story just in itself. Make a great movie, probably. But this is the title poem, and to me is probably the centerpiece of Yvonne's work over his lifetime in a lot of ways, you could say. 10,000 dawns, my angel, 10,000 dawns. 10,000 times the eye of the sun has come to open again our eyelids. 10,000 dawns for this one night of our love. Your head sculpted in my arms, the rose garden of your hair on fire with 10,000 red roses. Oh, what fireworks! And the 10,000 voices of waves. How many moons have passed, delirious or sad, covering us with the ecstasy of snow? And of old men who have lent us their eyes, and of children who have eaten our hearts in the 10,000 dreams of love. 10,000 dawns, my angel, 10,000 dawns. 10,000 eggs filled with birds and their songs. 10,000 sun yolks, more than make up for this death of 100,000 stars.
Nice, yeah. Good work.
And I'd like to read first a poem that shows how she felt the great loss of him at the time. She often thought of him as a tower of strength, an obelisk. And I'd like to read this one where she's thinking of him as her tower. My leaning tower, so weary from shouldering the stars, lean the precious limbs of your lofty frame on me. My passion will entangle you with a thousand arms of ivy, and its iron roots will brace your fragile body for fear it will collapse. Soar no more, my leaning tower. I cannot follow you on your ascension to the sun, for you would break apart and bury me alive under your noble ruins. I have a hard time reading these at the end.
That phrase, under your noble ruins, is just, it is heartbreaking. It is absolutely heartbreaking. Wow.
Yeah.
I will come around and say that after he died, she lived another 27 years, and she told Galway Canel when he visited her in Paris later after Yvonne's death.
Galway Canel being another of the translators of Yvonne's work.
He has an absolutely beautiful translation of Lackawanna Elegy.
It is. It's stunning.
And where was I going with that? She told him that in order to make up for any kind of unfaithfulness or sins of omission, whatever, that she had done in her life when he was alive, she was going to devote the rest of her life to promoting his work. And she did exactly that. She lived on to be 87 years old and kept putting his work out over and over again, in French and in German, because both of them were bilingual. I don't know if we mentioned that. That's also a great reason why they had such a breadth of friends. And when they were in the United States, he actually published a very stunning work called Fruit from Saturn. And it was a reaction to the United States dropping the atom bomb. And he was just contemplating what's the world coming to at the end of the war when we have this kind of destructive power. So, at any rate, Claire did carry the flag, as she never remarried, was entirely focused on promoting his work.
Yeah, an amazing career, or dual career.
And then those last poems, he was writing toward the end. He decided he would write only in German, and that's what that...
It's the dream grass,
that's
right?
That's it. The we call it Traumkraut, and I'm calling it dream weed.
Dream weed, which is even better in some
dream
ways.
Dream weed, right, dream weed, because he had this fantastical weed flower, I don't know what else you could call it, that was calling him, and giving him all sorts of surrealistic images at the end of his life.
Yeah.
And he also has some love poems to her in that book. And luckily it's going to be published in a little while. So we're very excited about that.
Sunday afternoon, and you're listening to Wordplay on Asheville FM. My guest today, Kathy Smith Bowers, and her guest are Thomas Raingrow and Nan Watkins. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks.
Thomas and Nan, as I was just saying, I will now have a whole new context, and so that when I go back and reread this amazing book, it will just
shimmer and explode in ways that, as much as I loved it before, I'm very excited about reading it again and again. I'm also interested in the process of translation. Could you talk a little bit about that process? Could I translate a poem even though I can barely speak English? So, you know.
I think so. I think I've got faith in you.
You must.
But no, I mean, that's a whole other subject and debate, you know, the whole idea of literal translation. And do you have to be a fluent speaker to be able to translate and to get it right? And I think the jury's out on all that. I mean, there's room for everybody and every approach. And I mean, if you look at people like Neruda, who have been translated, you know, by almost everybody. Nan, at one point, you know, got four or five different translations of a Neruda poem done by different people, and looked at all of them, and they're nothing like each other, not even similar. You wouldn't even know it was Neruda in some cases. So, I mean, you know, there's room for everything and everybody, and I think, you know, as long as you've got a good dictionary and a good thesaurus and a good imagination, you can go there. I don't speak French nearly as fluently as Nan speaks German. I've got, you know, lots of reference books that I use, and when I get stumped, I've got friends in France that I can consult with. And that's how I do it. But Nan, being a fluid speaker, doesn't have to go through quite as many hoops as I do. But, yeah, I think the door is open. And anybody who's interested in other languages and bringing other languages into English or other authors into English, you know, they're the ones that ought to give it a shot.
And I like to think how many poets have begun earlier in their career translating, and often they'll write about that process, saying that they love the poetry of, let's say, Neruda or Rilke, and they want to get inside of it and see if they can in some way reproduce it or make it intelligible or figure out how that particular poet was able to make such a brilliant expression. And think of Merwin or Rexroth or Connell, all these people, and many, many more.
Bly
was the big one, and Coleman Barks with all his work, and Thomas Crowe with his Hafez. And in those cases, often we're talking about a team, either using another, let's say, academic literal translation to work from, or working with a native speaker in a language that you really would not know. And Connell himself, I guess, doesn't really know German very well, but he found a German woman and worked together with her and published The Essential Rilke. But his own language was French. So yeah. I think it's an effort to get inside and see it as a great puzzle, as a challenge, as a... just an extremely rewarding experience, also frustrating when you're having trouble trying to figure out how can I make this beautiful in my own language. It's a wonderful challenge for me.
Right. I think of Jack Hirschman, the former poet laureate of San Francisco, who's translated from 30 different languages. Now, of course, he's not fluent in 30 languages, but he's got friends in the right places and works with them and is bringing poets from all over the world into English that people didn't know about before. And that's the cool thing. I remember in the 60s when, you know, there were very few translations of anybody except for the English-speaking poets from England and America. And then all of a sudden Robert Bly starts translating from the Spanish and does a little Rilke and a few other people, and all of a sudden the doors are open and it comes flooding in, and we're introduced to some fabulous poets from all over the world that we didn't even know existed.
It just occurred to me with what both of you are saying, instead of so if I wanted to try my hand at translating some of my favorite poets, going back to the original language, rather than thinking that I could do a good enough job to actually send it out into the world, just look at it as my own experience of getting closer to that work that I love, mm-hmm. in translation and moving into it in a deeper way, just for my own experience.
That reminds me exactly of something that I went through back in the 70s in San Francisco. I was in my 20s. I was hanging out with Jack Hirschman and a lot of the Beats, and Mayakovsky was all the rage at the time, the Russian poet, futurist poet. And what little there was in English, you know, I just lapped it up and loved it. I loved Mayakovsky, loved his voice, but I wanted it in the real, in the original language. So, as luck would have it, we knew a fellow on North Beach in the scene who was a genius at languages. And he started teaching us, a few of us, Russian, so that we could try to learn it well enough to where we could get some sense of Mayakovsky's work, you know, in the original language. Well, Russian is a very hard language, and we never got there. But that was our incentive to do exactly what you're suggesting.
And I think another thing that translators will often say or remember when they're working together is that translators can be the closest readers ever, because they have to so completely get inside the writing, as Kathy was saying, and in order to bring it out in a new form, they have to be thoroughly and completely inside of it. So it's just a great way to keep your mind going.
Yeah, an amazing process. Yeah.
What are you two working on now?
Well, Nan's working on, as we've been mentioning, more of Yvonne Gall's work, and she's just finished the Traumkraut collection. So to stay on the subject of the Galls and to carry that forward, maybe she would be the best person to answer that question. I've kind of jumped ship, and I'm writing prose.
I heard you were working on a novel, you dog.
Well,
arf.
Right.
The necessity is the mother of invention, my friend, and my bank account is dry. But timing being everything, it's a bad time to try to sell a novel in the publishing world. So, but in any case, I'm working on a book of poems with Wind Publications up in Kentucky. It's a book of poems about Western North Carolina and the mountains and nature over the last 20-25 years. Uh-huh. It's a compendium of poems, and so that's kind of what's got my attention. So,
well, good. And I'm so excited that Traumkraut has found a publisher, because it's been a couple of years,
right,
of struggle.
It's a difficult thing to find a publisher who wants to publish, as they would, some of the rejection letters say, a dead poet. I'd like to think of Yvonne Gall's work in a much more positive way than that, but it's hard times in the literary world, as it is in every other world right now. So I was especially excited that a younger publishing company called Black Lawrence Press, based in New York, but my editor is actually in Hong Kong. And so with the digital age, we can just communicate right across the world, and they're very eager to put this work out. I'm excited about
Excellent.
That.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. Well, do share some of those poems with us.
Okay. Well, I would say it has actually two facets to it. One is his great horror and fear of dying. And the other is he's still writing love poems very beautifully to Claire. And I think I'll just do a short one. Some of these poems have been published by both our Asheville Poetry Review and also the International Poetry Review down in Greensboro. So I'll just read one of these that's already been out in the world. It's one of his surreal poems called The Inner Trees. Now bear in mind, he's very ill and he's in great pain in these hospitals. The death-drunken trees of my years grow out of my head, hot with fruit and root, with hands and with suns, nimble, discreet animals. The light of Saturn glows in the eye of the golden frog, while on the meadows the comets bloom. He's in a different space. Really a very difficult time.
That has images of what I would think being in a heavy fever would call up. Very interesting. Amazing.
And I think a lot of the poems in Trump Crowd are very symbolic. He's drawing from the Kabbalah and from the Zodiac and astrology and all kinds of metaphysical places, almost reaching it for straws to find an answer to why he's been chosen to end his life at a young age.
All right, for another one, I'll ask you, would you rather hear one of the poems of his misery or a love poem to Claire? And if I do the love poem, I'll try to read it straight.
Can we have both?
All right, if we have time,
Jeff. Love and misery.
All right. This one came out in the Asheville Poetry Review. It's called This Holy Body. This shaky house of bones built upon sand, lodging for my ancestors. From my eyes they follow all the roads I take. My spleen is their kitchen where they cook with fat and blood. In the niche of the ruins, my mother still sleeps. Old men's tobacco smoke clings to her larynx. My holy body, sacrificial animals roar deep within me, and beef loins exhale their stench every Saturday. My mouth still houses century-old magic. In my ears, I hear a ringing and no God. I mean, he's in a very, very, very deep, very difficult place. And there are quite a few poems that are expressing extreme anguish. And he dies at the age of 58, so he did not think that he would be leaving this earth that soon. That's what I mean about having that death sentence of the leukemia. And I don't know what the doctors would have done for him today, but back in the 1940s, there was no way of saving him. But here's one that he wrote in the very last days in the hospital. He was in the American Hospital in Paris. And that's where, as Thomas said, all these poets and painters were lining up. One of the people who was lining up to donate blood was Paul Celan. And some people may have heard of a kind of mix-up there after his death, totally after his death. But Yvonne Gall really admired Celan, and it was mutual when he was alive. But here, this was written just at the time that Celan lined up to give some blood for Yvonne Gall. It's a love poem to Claire. Did I pluck you in the gardens of Ephesus, the curly hair of your carnations, the evening bouquet of your hands? Did I fish for you in the lakes of dream, an angler on your meadow's shores? I threw you my heart for food. Did I find you in the dryness of the desert? You were my last tree. You were the last fruit of my soul. Now I am wrapped in your sleep, bedded deep in your repose, like the almond in its night brown shell.
Thanks so much.
Nan Watkins and Thomas Raincrow, what a beautiful gift you have given us. What a beautiful gift. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for allowing us to join you here this afternoon and share the poems of Yvonne and Claire Gall.
Wow. Yes.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you.